Hi, I'm Yudi Bunyamin, and welcome to The Neumann Talk, a podcast where I meet past winners of the Australian Mathematical Society's B.H. Neumann Prize to learn about their journeys through the world of mathematics. This episode's guest is Benjamin Burton. Ben grew up in Logan, a city just outside Brisbane. He did his undergraduate degree with honours at the University of Queensland. He also had a short stint in the finance industry shortly after he finished his PhD. These days, Ben is a professor in pure mathematics at the University of Queensland. His main area of research is in topology. Ben is also well known for his work in outreach, most notably for his involvement in the National Mathematics Summer School and the International Olympiad of Informatics. Ben jointly won the B.H. Neumann Prize in 2003 while he was a PhD student at the University of Melbourne, working under the supervision of Chaim Rubinstein. So what do you remember of your Neumann Prize winning talk?
So it was a long time ago. It was maybe 17 years ago. I remember quite clearly what the topic was because it was something that I sort of proved a bit by accident, and I proved it. I was going in from the center of Sydney out to the University of Sydney, but I walked and I was going from coffee shop to coffee shop to coffee shop, and at each coffee shop, I did parts of the proof and sort of, and I during the space of this 45-minute walk, I started with no theorem and ended up with a result that ended up being in this B.H. Neumann talk.
Are you saying that you came up with the whatever was in the talk while you were in Sydney for the conference?
Oh, no. That was a different trip to Sydney. Different trip to Sydney.
Okay.
I didn't prove the theorem and then speak on it 2 days later.
Okay. All right.
But the
that would have been really cool. Especially for a PhD student.
I'm not that fast. So the conference itself, I think that was a special year. So the Australian Maths Society conference, which is where they have the B.H. Neumann talks, that was in conjunction with ICIAM, which is the International Congress on Applied and Industrial Mathematics, I think. I'm a pure mathematician, so I've never been to ICIAM before, but they're only every 4 years, and I think there's only been 10 of them ever or something. So it was in Sydney that year, and so they held that in conjunction with the Australian Maths Society conference, which means that instead of this little local Australian maths conference, it was this enormous international gala that was all across Darling Harbour and the convention centre and everything else. And the Australian Maths Society was a tiny, tiny piece on the side of that. It was nice. We got to see ICIAM running. We got to pop into some talks that we wouldn't normally see. We got some people popping into our talks who we wouldn't normally see. So the talk itself... giving the talk, I wasn't really nervous because I wrote the slides very close to the talk, and I think that's just me and my lack of time management skills. But it meant that I think there was so much adrenaline going that by the time I went to give the talk, I just gave it, and it was fine. And it was all in my head because I'd written the slides so recently. I wasn't worried about forgetting anything because it had all just come out of my head onto the page. So it was all there. It came across very naturally, possibly for all the wrong reasons. But I think the fact that it came across very naturally and it came across like I was saying it for the first time, because possibly I was, meant that it, again, for all the wrong reasons, I think it went down well with the audience. I think they saw the talk not as a series of rehearsed lines, but as a mathematician trying to explain something to other mathematicians in like a casual way that tries to give them a big picture without hammering in detail after detail after detail, which I think is what you want for this kind of talk. I do remember it a bit more vividly than I should. The presentation I remember too, because the presentation was at the banquet when they present the awards for the B.H. Neumann talks. But I wasn't going to go to the banquet because it was scheduled at the same time as ICIAM. There was some extra fee and I was a poor starving student, and so I hadn't paid the fee. So I was supposed to be having just dinner at a small little takeaway place somewhere with my husband. And the chair of the committee came up to me and said, "Are you coming to the dinner?" And I said, "No, we're going somewhere else." And he said, "Maybe you'd like to come to the dinner." I said, oh, okay. And he said, we'll get you free tickets to the dinner. And it's like, oh, okay. I guess maybe I've won a thing. Yeah. And then.
So you did have hints that you were going to win. Like, did it occur to you before that you might win?
Well, no, not at all. Because, no, I mean, I was giving the talk because I was happy to have a theorem, right? I mean, I'm a PhD student. You don't have that many theorems when you're a PhD student because you're not that fast. So I was just super excited to even have something that I could talk about.
So when you properly found out that you won, do you remember what was going through your head? Like, were you really surprised? Or?
To be honest, I think my first reaction was, oh my goodness, we have to rearrange all our dinner plans. my husband had a friend visiting from Turkey as well. And so she was with us in Sydney. And so there was some social reorganization that had to happen. And then it was all such a rush that it was very nice to get the award. But that was not the most pressing thing on my mind.
I remember you were there the night that I won, and in fact I didn't think I was going to win, and I barely knew that you get this nice frame certificate, you know, if you win. And because I won, a couple of us decided to go out and celebrate that night, and I was thinking, oh my goodness, I have to bring this thing around to this to these pubs. And Ben, who happened to have a bag that night, you know, carried my prize around for me the whole night. That was quite convenient.
But I'm just happy I remembered to give it back.
I would have remembered. I definitely would have remembered to get it back from you. But you've been to many AustMSs since. How do you think it's changed? Like, the student talks have changed over the years.
I don't think they've changed enormously, but also, I mean, when you see student talks as a student, that's quite different from seeing student talks as someone who's been watching student talks for that many years, right? It's somehow, even if they're all the same, you have a different perspective of them. You see them differently. I think one thing that I've seen at conferences in general over the last maybe 10 years is that some people are getting much better at doing up slides that complement the talk instead of getting in the way of the talk, right? It's like, how many people do you see give a talk where they put up slide after slide with a wall of text, and either you're reading the text and you're not listening, or you're listening to the talk but you're not reading the text, and either way around, you've missed something, and then three slides on, you've forgotten what it was that was on the slide three slides ago, and they expect you to remember. And there is absolutely an art to using slides well, and I think a lot of people haven't learned that art. And I think what you see is that younger people are often much better at sort of looking at the talk from the outside and realizing what it is that will make the slides work and make the slides not work. I think I've seen very good talks from very well-established people, and I've seen very bad talks from very well-established people. And I think students are often sort of at the bleeding edge of these kinds of cultural improvements as to how we communicate as mathematicians, which I think students also pay more attention to than maybe we did when we were students. And I think that's a good thing.
So I want to take it back quite a long way and ask you, what were you like as a child?
I mean, as a child,
were there any signs that you were going to end up being a mathematician?
Well, I think I was pretty awful as a child. I liked puzzles. I liked logic games. I liked, probably there were hints, right? I liked computer programming. I think computer programming has a lot more in common with mathematics than a lot of people think. I think computer science is, to me, much closer to pure mathematics than most of the other sciences, like physics and chemistry and biology and the rest of those. I think because it's a similar level of if you're gonna do mathematics, it's not enough to see patterns. You need to be able to see patterns. It's not enough, right? You need to be rigorous and logical, and you need to have no gaps in your arguments, and you need to be able to see every single thing that could go wrong and account for every single thing that could go wrong. And these are skills that you need as a pure mathematician. They're also skills that you need as a computer programmer, because you can't tell the computer program to just go work it out on its own, right? It's somehow, you have to remember everything that the computer has to do. You can't have any gaps. You have to be completely logical, completely rigorous. And so the skills are really the same. And so I think the fact that I got into computer programming at a young age as well probably was another hint that I would have ended up in one of those two areas. When I did my PhD, I applied for PhDs in both those areas, and I ended up in mathematics because my honors supervisor from computer science suggested that I should go into mathematics. But anyway, I think for the right reasons. So,
but I mean, you dabbled into a lot of things during your undergrad. Why, Matt? Why did you feel like doing an undergrad in mathematics?
So I think the undergrad in mathematics, I think, was sort of it was almost an automatic step in that that was where I was heading in high school anyway. I did a lot of outreach programs as a high school student. And I know you're involved in a lot of outreach programs as well. I think these are fantastic. I was in the Maths Olympiad. I went to the National Maths Summer School. There was a bunch of other things as well. And it was sort of a lot of it was centered around mathematics and some computer science, but a lot of mathematics. And so I think the way that I had expanded myself, or that I had been expanded beyond the high school syllabus, sort of the main area in which that happened was maths. So that was what I was super excited to see more of at university. So I just sort of naturally fell into that without really thinking too hard. I think that the much more interesting decision was staying in mathematics for a PhD, because that was possibly the first time I actually sat down and thought maybe I want to stay in this area, maybe I want to leave this area. So that was the harder decision, I think.
Yeah, because when you were in high school, when you say that was the thing you engaged with the most outside of the curriculum, I mean, you engaged with it a lot. You're one of a very small handful of Australians who can say that they have a gold medal from the International Maths Olympiad. It's not like you were just doing maths every Saturday afternoon.
Well, how do I say this, right? I think one comes from the other. So you don't just sort of rock up and get a gold medal at the Maths Olympiad, right? The reason I was able to get that medal was not because I was brilliant. It was because I did a ton of work. and the ton of work was a ton of work that was done through these sorts of outreach programs. Without all those outreach programs, that would have never happened.
So why did you decide to stay in maths after undergrad?
I think in my undergrad, when I did honors, I did joint honors in maths and computer science. The computer science side was informal because I didn't have the right prerequisites for it. So I had the supervisor and I had the thesis, but on my CV, it comes up as special topics in applied mathematics 3AH. But the maths thesis was, it was in combinatorics, which is a fancy word for counting. And when I say a fancy word for counting, it was sort of more like Sudoku sort of kind of, it's like what Ian Wandless does. I understand. Yes. You interviewed Ian Wandless. Yeah. Recently. So that was what my honors thesis was in mathematics. In computer science, my honors thesis was in natural language processing, which is basically trying to get computers to understand English. And if you've ever watched lawyers trying to understand English, you'll get an appreciation for how hard it is for computers to understand English. It's a fantastically imprecise, ambiguous language where there are far too many ways of saying the same thing. And far too many ways of misunderstanding what is being said. And so being able to turn that into some sort of, I mean, basically you want to be, Siri or whatever Google has that's not Siri. You want to be some automated assistant where somebody talks to you in English and you perform the task that was asked of you. So I found that a lot more fun than the maths project, probably because I think the maths project I was working on was sort of a toy problem somehow, and the computer science project was far more ambitious. It was way too ambitious, right? Knowing what I know now, I would never in my right mind have actually done a thesis in it. But it was a real problem. Right? It was a real problem where you could build a real thing that solved a real task that people actually wanted to do. Not very well, as mine was very limited in what it could do, but still. So that was quite exciting, and that almost made me want to do a PhD in the same area. And I had I applied for a scholarship at Macquarie, where they had a natural language center running at the time. I had a potential supervisor lined up. At the same time, I had a PhD scholarship and potential supervisor lined up. And at the end of the day, I had to decide. I think I made the decision the day before I had to put a final notice of acceptance in. So it was. It could have gone either way. I think what swung me to mathematics in the end was that it is, and I think this was correct, I think it is easier to be in mathematics and stay involved in computer science than it is to be in computer science and stay involved in mathematics. I think pure mathematics, it really helps to be just immersed in it. So I think for me, that was the right way around. And so this is what I do nowadays for my day job. I'm a mathematician. I'm immersed in pure mathematics, but I'm working on computational topology, which means I'm writing mathematical software. I'm designing processes for machines to solve geometric problems quickly and correctly, which is not easy. I'm analyzing software and computational methods in geometry, but I'm doing that from a maths department. And I think I'm happy that I'm doing it that way around.
That leads me to ask, I like to frame the question this way. If not you, but if I were speaking to a random person at the pub and they were to ask me, what does Ben Burton do? What is Ben's research about? What should I tell them?
You should tell them that Ben teaches supercomputers how to untangle knots. That's my 10-word answer. If I want to give you the 1-minute answer, right? Here's a poster child problem in our area, which nobody knows how to solve. So I give you a knot. What's a knot? I understand this is audio, not visual, so I'm going to try not to wave my hands around too much. A knot, it's like take a loop of string, sort of tie it all up, and then glue the ends together. So there's no free end, right? It's a loop of string that's closed up on itself, but maybe it's all tangled up. And what you want to know is whether you can untangle that loop of string without cutting it. So you want to untangle it so it's just a circle. It's just an untangled loop. You're allowed to stretch it. You're allowed to twist it as tightly as you want. You're allowed to pull it as long or as short as you want. You're just not allowed to cut. There's no scissors, right? And so the answer is either yes or no. I mean, either you can untangle it or you can't. It's a perfectly well-defined problem with a perfectly well-defined answer. You can give this problem to a computer. So the computer, I don't know, takes a photograph of the knot, and then it's got the geometric information about where the knot sits in space, and it tries to work out whether you can untangle the knot. And you want the computer to get this problem right all of the time, and you want it to be fast. So we know how to do it so that it's right all of the time, but it's slow. And we know how to do it so it's fast all of the time, but sometimes it gets it wrong. But we can't do both together. We still don't know how to have a solution that is always correct and always quick. And if you could do that, you would be the darling of the computational topology community. So that's a big open problem in our area.
So, I mean, there's a lot of computation in there, right? I mean, sort of is consistent with your background of like you've always dabbling between maths and computer science. But after hearing that description, I think a lot of people might be wondering, where's the maths in that? It seems like a computer science project.
Yeah, look, I mean, where's the maths? I think one of the things that surprised me most when I got into this area, and the area is called topology, and it's basically topology is all about looking at geometric objects, but ignoring distances and angles and small measurements and fine details and just looking at the big picture, right? So a sphere is the same as a football because they're sort of, you can take one and hammer it until it looks like the other. But a sphere is different from a donut because you'd have to punch a hole through the sphere, right? So somehow you're interested in geometric objects and you don't care what happens when you wiggle them around, but you do care that you're not allowed to cut or glue or break them in any way. So in this area, I think one of the most surprising things I saw, and this was in one of these outreach programs as a high school student, this was at the National Math Summer School, was that you could take these very wibbly-wobbly, geometric, fuzzy questions and make them precise and exact and logical and mathematical. And there were some very clever tricks that did that, and that blew my little mind away. Basically, the sorts of tricks that you can use. So one of them is you take your geometric object, you break it up into some flat pieces. So if it's a knot, right, you break the knot up into line segments. If it's a sphere or a donut, some sort of surface, you break it up into lots of triangles that are stapled together. The same way that if you're designing a computer game, like a first-person shooter or something, where you're sort of zipping through corridors and whatever, and there's these nice smooth pictures of landscapes, but if you zoom in far enough, there are lots of little triangles all stapled together, right? So you build your surface out of these triangles, and then you start counting vertices and edges of the triangles and counting how many triangles glue to how many other triangles. And then the answers to some of these questions, surprisingly, only depend on topology. So they don't depend on measurements or angles or whatever. What they depend on is whether or not you have to punch a hole through one surface to make it look like another. So this numerical information about triangles and line segments actually converts quite precisely to sort of wibbly-wobbly geometric intuition, and it turns your problem into something that is real mathematics. And it's surprising. You sort of don't believe it until you see it. I think it's one of the attractions of the area is that you can even do this at all.
So what drew you into this area? How did you get into all of this stuff?
Okay. So I think...
Because your honors was in combinatorics. And I mean, you do a lot of different things. I mean, if we look at sort of the different areas of math you dabbled in, there's a bit of, you know, obviously all the things related to computer science, you know. You do a lot of, you still do a bit of combinatorics or things that we would associate with combinatorics. Even do a bit of optimization, which we would traditionally associate with applied math, even though you call yourself a pure mathematician. I guess this seems to be the main thing, right? So how did you get into that?
So I guess there's two answers. So the area I'm in is computational topology, right? So the first question is, how did I get into topology? And the second is, how did it become computational? So how did I get into topology? I think the first taste I had really was this course at the National Math Summer School where they did this geometry of surfaces, and we saw how to take these geometric problems and turn them into quite rigorous mathematical problems. And it, in three dimensions, and when I say three dimensions, I mean spheres, donuts. So these are two-dimensional surfaces that live in three-dimensional space, right? So when I say a sphere, you think of a beach ball. You think of a surface of a sphere, right? It's a two-dimensional material that is bent around and comes back around on itself, like a beach ball, like a balloon. So this is called two-dimensional topology, even though it's described surfaces that we would put in three dimensions. So this kind of stuff it's hard the first time you see it, but once you get used to it, it's easy in the sense that you can give a week-long course at the National Math Summer School and teach everybody sort of like the core basics of everything that you need to know about two-dimensional topology, right? And at the very end of this course, the lecturer said, by the way, if you do this all one dimension higher, and if you can solve the problems there, then you'll win a Fields Medal, right? Which is like the Nobel Prize for mathematics. That's wrong. The Nobel Prize is like the Fields Medal for the sciences. Anyway, so I thought, you know, stupid, ambitious me thought, okay, I'll sit down and solve these problems one dimension higher. So I went home and played with it for 6 months. Of course, I got absolutely nowhere because the problems are very, very hard. But I got interested in it as a result. And so this is what's called three-dimensional topology, and it's really about things that have to live in four and five dimensions. So you can't picture them very well. But anyway, it's called three-dimensional topology. So that was my first taste of it. They didn't teach it in my undergrad that I was studying here. I think most universities probably don't teach much three-dimensional topology at all. But there was a guest speaker who came in once and gave a talk on knots, like K-N-O-T-S, knots. And it turns out that the mathematics of knots is very, very closely related for some very good reasons to the mathematics of three-dimensional topology, so much so that you call them all of this is just three-dimensional topology and includes knots as well. So that talk also blew my mind for similar reasons in that you could take all of these wibbly-wobbly knot problems and basically turn them all into polynomials, right? It is like the sort of algebra that you do in high school, and it's not at all clear that this should work until you actually see it. So I still found that exciting enough that at the end of the day, I decided to do a PhD in it, even though I'd really learned nothing about it. And it's maybe this was a daft idea, going to do a PhD in a completely new field, but I was interested enough, and I thought I'd like a change from what I was doing in my honors. So I talked to Chaim, he suggested some problems, and I went down to Melbourne and off I went in this completely different area. So that was how I got into topology. How did I get into computational topology? Sort of what happened is I got down to Melbourne in this field where I knew nothing. I was surrounded by topologists, real topologists, who knew a lot more than I did. And as a PhD student, I mean, you know this, right? As a PhD student, you have to produce new mathematics. So you have to be able to do things that nobody has ever done before. And here's me, a complete bunny, right, in this area, surrounded by all of these experts, right? And what can I possibly do that they can't? And one of the things was that I came into this PhD with something that almost none of them had, which was a strong background in computer programming and some computer science and some combinatorics. And so what I ended up doing was applying these areas to topological problems. And so the B.H. Neumann talk was basically about one of my first successful attempts theoretically at applying ideas from combinatorics mainly from combinatorics, applying that to topological problems. What I'm best known for in the field is my mathematical software, which involves a lot of, you talked about optimization, combinatorics, computer science, data structures, algorithms, all of this stuff packaged into hundreds of thousands of lines of code, which make up this body of mathematical software, which other people actually want to use, right? So this is somehow, whatever theorems I'm proudest of, nobody cares nearly as much as they care about the software that I write, because the software that I write, they can actually use it themselves, right? And so it's a tool for other people. So that's, I think, been the most productive thing that's come out of my career. And that came about because that was a skill I brought to an area where other people knew much more topology than me, but I knew much more computer science than anybody else. And so that's where I was useful. And so that's where I started being able to do new things, if that makes any sense.
No, it does make sense. I've sort of, even very early on in my PhD, began to realize that myself, because I'm working in combinatorics, which is something that is very traditionally associated as pure mathematics. And in fact, I worked in design theory, which is more or less what your honors was about. But if I look at the results that I've come up with so far there, and if I sort of ponder upon why no one else had ever found them, like why some, nobody PhD student found them before lots of other great mathematicians, I think it's because I have a stats background. I was trained in statistics, and the ways in which I found these results were very much inspired by statistics. So I totally relate with that. I think it's a common thread amongst a lot of mathematicians that they all have something that's unique about them, like a different combination of experiences that explain why they were the first people to discover certain things.
Yeah. I think this is something in computational topology. This is something that's gotten people very excited in the last decade, is that for the first time, really, there's some serious, not just communication, but collaboration between pure mathematicians and computer scientists. So this is a much more heavy duty version of what I was just talking about. So you're getting people in the same room at the same conferences who have these very different skills. And instead of watching a talk, like if you go to a topology conference, you watch an hour long talk with lots of details and lots of hardcore stuff that I'm trying to find a nice way of saying that often I will understand 10 minutes of the hour, right? And I'm certain I'm not the only person in the room who only understands 10 minutes of that hour. So what happens at these computational topology conferences where you get a room full of computer scientists and pure mathematicians is that people make an effort to communicate, right? They make an effort to communicate well. So the mathematicians are trying to talk in a way that is illuminating to the computer scientists, and the computer scientists are trying to talk in a way that is illuminating to the mathematicians. And as a result, everybody wins, right? And as a side effect, the other mathematicians in a room can understand each other's mathematical talks because they're set at a level which is designed not just for them and their own immediate collaborators, right? So I think those kinds of conferences are very successful just because everybody can talk about the same sorts of problems and bring their different skills because everyone's making an effort to do that. I love it. So this is quite new in our field in some sense. And there's some great results coming out of it, as you were saying.
I want to talk a bit about another big component of your career, which is your outreach work. I mean, that's probably something you're very well known for in Australia. In fact, when I gave my Neumann talk, that was in the first EDI session, the first time that the AustMS conference had an EDI session, and you spoke two turns before I did. I remember when I first looked at the run sheet for that day, when they first released the schedule for that day, and I saw the people who I was talking around, and it's like me, just some PhD student talking around the likes of Ben Burton. That got me really nervous, to be honest. But I think the one thing that surprised me was that you chose to talk about the IOI, the International Informatics Olympiad, which, because you went to the International Maths Olympiad, and you would think that if at all, you'd be very heavily involved in the International Maths Olympiad, but actually you've been working on the IOI for a very long time.
Yeah, look, I think so. So by the way, I'll just start by saying that when I gave that talk, I was petrified about that talk because it's one of the few times I've gone to a maths conference and talked about something which is not a mathematical result, which means I'm talking about something which I know I'm not an expert. And I think this is probably true with a lot of people talking about the so for those who are listening, the EDI stands for Equity, Diversity and Inclusion. So this was the first time that the Australian Maths Society had a whole room blocked off for a couple of days to talk about equity, diversity and inclusion in mathematics. And it was fantastic. And it's also, I mean, you do your best to try and improve things in the equity and diversity and inclusion sphere, but at the same time, you are painfully aware that you are not an expert, right? I have some training. I go to efforts to educate myself, but there are big holes in what I know. There are big holes in what I do, I'm sure. And they're big enough holes that I don't know what they are, right? So I'm talking about an area where I know I probably shouldn't be talking, but I'm talking about it anyway because I'm trying to. I mean, if everybody is petrified that they don't know what they're doing, then nobody does anything. So you just have to do something and be willing to keep learning and keep being aware that you have holes that need to be filled. But yeah, so I was super nervous about my talk as well, if that's any consolation.
Yeah, I think I've subsequently learned that all of us speaking in that session were equally petrified as I was.
Yeah. But yeah, like the IOI, so the Informatics Olympiad, and for those who don't know informatics, it's the fancy European word for computer science. So the Informatics Olympiad is one of the science Olympiads. Basically, it's a big international competition with teams and medals and ceremonies and things. And the problems, you don't write solutions with pen and paper, you write code. So you write software, right? And the problems go along the lines of write a computer program that can read in this sort of information and can do this sort of computation. So an example, one of my favorite examples from 10 years ago now was in Canada, where the problem was the following. You have Wikipedia, which is translated into umpteen different languages. So what they did was they took 50 languages that Wikipedia is translated into, and they downloaded, I don't know, thousands of articles from each of these 50 languages. And for each article, they took the first 100 symbols in the article. So what is a symbol? It's a letter, it's punctuation, it's a space, just the first 100 key presses to make up that article, right? And what your computer program had to do was read those 100 letters or spaces or punctuation, those 100 keystrokes, and work out what language of Wikipedia it was taken from. So you see 100 characters, you say, oh, that's Polish, right? And you see 100 characters, you say, oh, that's Japanese, and so on. And this is a super hard problem for people who are trained as mathematicians because it's not precise, right? If you landed on an article which is about a film, such as The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, for instance, right? That's a film title, which on its own takes up probably 40 characters. So even if you've downloaded the French edition of Wikipedia, the first 40 characters are in English, yeah? So it's like, what are you going to do? So it's a hard problem if you approach it as a pure mathematician. It gets much easier if you approach it as a statistician, which people are not used to in the Informatics Olympiad. But at the end of the day, your software had to read 100 characters and return a language, right? A language code. And so these are the kinds of problems that you solve in the Informatics Olympiad. The reason I got into that was because it was in 1997, they decided they should start sending Australian teams. And the organization that was sending the Australian teams was the Australian Maths Trust, which is the same organization that sends the Maths Olympiad teams. And they basically grabbed anyone they knew who know anything about computers. And we had this meeting, sit-down meeting at Monash, and turned out that only three of us were actually interested in doing any serious work. And one of the three of us didn't want to travel. So the other two of us became the team leader and deputy leader. And there we were training the teams and taking them off to, I think our first year was Turkey 1999. So that was how I got into it. It was kind of by accident, right? But not just by accident. So I'd also been involved in the university versions of these programming competitions when I was at university. So that's the International Collegiate Programming Competition. I got into it and I love it because the problems are interesting. The hard part of the Olympiad is not writing the code, right? The code is just the vessel through which you submit your solution, right? It's just the medium through which you communicate your answer. The hard part is designing the algorithm. The hard part is working out what are you even going to get the machine to do? How should a machine take 100 letters and work out what language it is, right? What kind of computations are you going to do to answer that problem? That's the hard part of the tasks. And that's just as much mathematics as it is computer science. So the problems are bang in between those two fields. And my own research is bang in between those two fields. So it's a very nice fit for me. So I hung around, trained the team for 10 years, and then I ended up on the committees. We hosted it in 2013 in Brisbane. Nowadays, I'm a politician, so I'm in the back room arguing about rules and regulations and criteria and disqualifications. Not that we want to do that very often. How are we going to run the Olympiad online, which we did last month, surprisingly successfully. I'm amazed at how well the Olympiad worked online. And at least we know that if we have to do it again next year, we can. But not that anybody wants to. But anyway, yes. So I feel like there was a question that you asked, and I don't know what it was.
I mean, you also, what your talk at the conference was about was working on inclusivity within the Olympiad community as well. So you do a lot of more political, as you said, political things these days.
I mean, again, I'm not an expert, and none of us on the committee are experts. And if everybody doesn't do anything because they're an expert, or everybody doesn't do anything because they wait for somebody better qualified to come and do it, or someone with more energy to come and do it, or someone for whom it's going to be easier to come and do it, then nothing will ever get done, right? So I think what prompted, at some point I made a shift within the Olympiad from pushing these sorts of issues at a low level to pushing them at a very sort of forceful high level. And I think what changed into becoming the correct word is you sort of try to champion these issues on the committee, right? You're the one who's pushing them in front of the committee, trying to get things changed. So I think what changed that for me was we went through a few years there's no nice way to say it, right? So there was harassment of women going on behind the scenes, sometimes that we didn't see, and most of it was being done anonymously. And this was happening at certain events in the Olympiad. And I think it was happening to the extent that it was starting to become a bit of a culture. And so it became very clear that we needed to, like, this needed to not be part of the culture. We worked through a range of things from talking to team leaders, who are the way that we get in touch with the students, and getting them to talk to the students, realizing that that wasn't necessarily effective because not all team leaders were as good as each other at communicating this with their students, to sort of trying to talk to the students directly, to try and implement sort of policies that would sort of enforce this in a way that complements, like, so there's now both carrot and stick, right? But also just trying to change the culture. And this is more, I mean, it's not enough to have carrots and sticks to stop people misbehaving. You need to actually change the culture so nobody sees any need to harass people, right? I mean, people no longer see this as a fun game that boys play, right? It's uncool, right? And you need people to realize, and people to have pressure from their own peers to understand that it's uncool. Yeah. So trying to get that culture shift was sort of the bigger battle. And I think, I mean, you can never say that you've won this battle, but I think things are certainly improved now than they were, let's say 4 years ago, for instance. And there is more to do, but I think, I mean, cross my fingers, right? But I think things are improving. So I think this is working. We do still have an appallingly unbalanced gender ratio at the Olympiad. So I believe the percentage of women in the competition is one digit. I believe it's a high one-digit number, but it's a one-digit. So I think I need to look up my statistics. I would have looked them up if I'd known you were going to ask this question. But I think it's somewhere between 5% and 10%. I think, which is low, which is super low compared to people who are actually in the field, and certainly compared to people who can actually solve these kinds of problems. And so we need to find out what's keeping women away. It's the same problem that you see in many other fields, where on the one hand you have people saying this is a meritocracy, right? Who who gets to compete, it's the best four people from each country. What's best? Best means they perform best at the exams. But on the other hand, whether or not exams, you have these systematic things in place that deter people from being engaged in the program at all, that deter people from committing themselves to these kinds of competitions, that deter people from entering these hyper-competitive environments. And so it's you have to look at what aspects of the way that we set up the program are keeping. I say women, but it's a bigger question with other underrepresented groups as well. But it's somehow, what are we doing structurally that could improve, that could just have more women engaged in the program at all? And I think if there are more women engaged in the program at all, sitting national competitions, then of course we're going to get more people attending attending the international competition of all genders. Because I think part of the problem is the initial pool of students that we're drawing from in each country is overwhelmingly male. So the problem is not that women can't do it, and the problem is not necessarily that women are being pushed away from it. I think the problem is that we're just not getting them in the first place, and we have to look at why that is and what it is that we can do. Right? So these are the kinds of bigger problems that there are no, I think, simple solutions to, and or that everybody has solutions to, which are different and self-contradictory, and none of us are completely qualified, and that shouldn't stop any of us from trying. So I don't know if that answered your question at all.
Well, that's definitely interesting. I'm definitely not going to push for it and have a solution for how to do that in a podcast. But you spend a lot of time on outreach. Like I said, this is something that you're very well known for in Australia. It's not just with the IOI, lots of other things, which we've already mentioned in this podcast. But I guess when you sign up to be a mathematician, or when you decide I'm going to do a PhD, you don't imagine spending a good chunk of your time in politics, arguing these kind of things. Why do you do a lot of outreach?
The outreach question is easier than the politics question. The outreach question is because I love it. The students are great. There's one of them who the audience can't see because he's on mute at the moment, making sure the Zoom call works. But yeah, there's the students in these sorts of programs it's an absolute gift to work with them. Right, they're engaged. They're good. You can push them. You can throw them interesting problems that you can't throw a high school class, and you can't necessarily sort of throw a first year class, right? So it's absolutely a gift to be able to teach these sorts of people. Why the politics? I can give you the answers to why I got into the politics and an answer to why I stayed. And they're different answers. So the reason I got into it is because I spent 6 years on the scientific committee for the Olympiad, which is the body that's responsible at the end of the day for the exam. So this is the committee that oversees selection of the tasks, right? The actual problems that the students have to solve during the competition. So this is an enormously fun job, right? You're basically sitting there solving difficult problems, making up difficult problems, tweaking them, sort of managing the competition from the back room as it happens. It's a lot of fun, and it's scientific work and it's technical work and it's and you're with like-minded people, and I love it. But it became clear to me while I was doing that the people on the committee, like the political committee, the one that I'm on now, this is like the IOC for this thing, right? It's the people who are actually developing all the policies around it. It became clear to me that those people had no idea what the scientific side were doing. Yeah. So they would occasionally pass legislation that made no sense, that was aimed at what we were doing, and that we would have to go back and explain. Yeah. They mean well. It's just that they were too disconnected from what was going on the scientific side. So originally I ran for election for this committee in order to have some better communication between the scientific side and the political side, so that the politicians knew what the techies were doing. Yeah. And also so the techies had some insight as to what was coming down the pipeline from the politicians. I think in both directions that communication needed to improve. So that was why I joined. But why I stayed, because that was probably 5 years ago now, 6 years ago now, why I stayed and I ran for election again to kind of do more. And I think that's because what you realize once you're on this political body is that this is the body that gets to shape, the whole structure of the Olympiad. It gets to shape the way that it presents itself, the way that it runs, in the COVID-19 year, right? You're trying to do these trade-offs between making it accessible and making it well proctored, making it possible for people to compete in countries that are under heavy lockdowns and restrictions and so on, versus making it possible for people who win medals to show these medals to universities and get scholarships because the universities trust that the exam was sat fairly, right? So these are not easy trade-offs to make. And we're the committee that's doing that with advice from other places, of course. But this is where you can actually shape it in a way that you want to improve it and in a way that you can sort of make it into what you think is better.
I know that you also spend a lot of time on encouraging the sorts of thinking that's required to solve the problems at this Olympiad, not just at the elite international Olympiad level, but also more locally and more earlier on in the progression. One of the articles which I found really interesting that you wrote was about encouraging algorithmic thinking without a computer. Because I think we all, like you said, when you train students for the IOI, most of the time is actually spent not on the computer, right? But that was really interesting because when I read the article, it was a lot like what we're aspiring to do. My project is aspiring to do. What does it mean to encourage algorithmic thinking without a computer? What does it mean to do computer science without a computer?
Yeah, look, I mean, I guess what you're trying to pick up on there is that I think to me, and I think to a lot of people, what's interesting about computer science is not actually writing the code. It's designing, as I was saying before, it's designing what is the computer even going to do to solve these kinds of problems. You give a computer a Sudoku puzzle, how it's going to solve the Sudoku puzzle, right? You can't just randomly put numbers into the puzzle and see if it works, and if not, try again, because maybe you'll never find the solution that way. You can't try all possible combinations of numbers, because if you have, I don't know, if you have like 100 empty squares, how big is a Sudoku? It's not even 100 squares. So if you have 50 empty squares in a Sudoku, and there's 10 possible digits for each square, you have 10 to the power of 50 possible combinations of digits, which you can't possibly iterate through on a computer in 10 minutes or in a century or probably in your lifetime, right? So you need to be clever about how you solve it. And so suddenly you're faced with the problem of how do you tell the computer, how do you teach a computer how to solve a mathematical problem in a way that is not just brute force, in a way that does something clever, right? And that clever thing is not coming from the computer itself. It's coming from a brain, coming from a human brain. So what we're trying to get at with these kinds of problems, algorithmic thinking without a computer, is getting people to think of these processes, these algorithms, right? Use their brains in the same way. It's just they never actually have to write code, right? But they're, you give them a puzzle, not a Sudoku, maybe something else, but maybe give them a Sudoku, right? Say, here, solve the Sudoku. And they have to find some systematic way of doing it, which they realize will eventually lead them to find the solution. And they realize will also not take them all day to solve, right? That is, it's both correct and fast. And they need to develop some process in their head that's correct and fast, but they're doing it on pen and paper.
So is computer science just maths then? I mean, is the algorithms just maths? What's your view on that?
No. Okay. So I'm being a bit cheeky, I guess. So when I say computer science, I'm probably talking almost exclusively about theoretical computer science. So theoretical computer science, if you read research papers in theoretical computer science, they read like definition one, theorem two, lemma three. They read the same as a pure maths paper. Right? But having said that, the problems they're trying to solve are almost always algorithmic problems. So in mathematics, so let's go back to topology, right? This area of knot theory, which I work in. So if I give you a two-dimensional space and I say, can you wiggle this around so it looks like a sphere, like a beach ball? Right? This is an easy problem to solve. But if you go one dimension higher and I say I give you a three-dimensional space living in four dimensions, and can you wiggle it around so it looks like a sphere? This is fantastically hard, and nobody knew how to do it until the 1990s. Actually, it was my PhD supervisor who solved that problem, which was Chaim Rubinstein. And that's possibly, I mean, I don't want to speak on his behalf, but that's possibly the thing he's most famous for, or at least certainly one of the things he's most famous for, is solving this problem. When he solved it, he showed that there was a way to solve the problem. So there exists an algorithm, yeah? There is a solution to this problem. That was a huge result to the mathematicians. If you actually tried to code it up as a computer program, it would be completely impossible. First of all, you would need far too much code that you'd never be able to write the program in the first place. And even if you could, it would take far too long to run that you'd never be able to use it. So for a mathematician, the fact that the problem was solvable was a huge result. To a computer scientist, what's interesting is making the problem fast and still correct and being able to analyze how fast it can possibly be, right? And so these are the sorts of problems that distinguish computer science from mathematics. I think computer science are often interested in not just how to solve a problem, but whether you can solve it quickly, how to solve it quickly, whether you can show that there should not be a solution to solve it quickly. So this ties into P versus NP, which is basically, can you build a timetable for a university without clashes quickly, or is that impossible? And if you can solve that problem, you can solve the same problem with knots. And that's another story for another time. So these I think computer science efficiency and speed is intimately tied into what they do in a way that it's not as mathematicians.
So do you think that in general, people, especially say high school students, don't have enough of understanding of the importance of maths if they want to go into computer science? I mean, I know many people, say, who in high school wanted to be, who said, you know, I wanted to study computer science at university. And I look at them and go, but you're not a very good math student. What do you think is the general understanding these days?
I think people need to understand. I think people could have a better understanding than they do that both links are important. I think to be a good computer scientist, you have to be a good mathematician, because computers are logical devices, right? I mean, you, just like a mathematician, as I was saying an hour ago now, I think at the very beginning, if you're going to write software for a computer, you have to think of every possible thing that can go wrong. You have to think of every possible case that can happen. You need to analyze the code mathematically and write the code mathematically and rigorously and painstakingly in the same way that a mathematician does. You can't just rely on experiment and testing and say it's good enough, yeah? Because that's not how computers work. So I think absolutely you need mathematics to do computer science well. The other way around, I think, is important as well. You need computer science to do mathematics well. I think people are sort of fast discovering that even if you are a pure mathematician who never does anything that is not on pen and paper and who never goes near a computer unless it's to answer your email or look for cat videos, right? I think even these sorts of people are realizing now that if you have someone who knows how to write a piece of code and can run some tests and run through 1,000 examples and look for a pattern or test a conjecture, then that's an enormous benefit. It's a tool that is worth having in your toolbox. And I think if you look 20 years ago, the way people did this was they got PhD students who could write code and asked them to do it. And nowadays, people are starting to write the code themselves because it's becoming more of an essential skill in mathematics. So, look, I mean, I know some young people who won't touch code, and I know some sort of 70-year-olds who are excellent coders, so please don't take any of this as generalizations. I think absolutely in both directions, computer science and maths go hand in hand, and you need one to do the other well.
Yeah, like I had a look at some of the questions that appear on these these informatics Olympiads, especially the ones that, you know, are pen and paper. And I look at them and go, this is not easy. Like, I have to think about, you know, I have to think
good,
about this.
Good,
and
good.
My computing is not so horrible. I mean, my PhD is quite computational, actually, but I have to stop and really think about it. And I can only imagine if you're like a high school student who, you know, is seeing these things for the first time, it can be quite overwhelming, you know. But what do you think we could be doing to, you know, I don't want to say fix that, but like what could we be doing in high schools to give people a better sense of algorithmic thinking or even mathematical thinking in general?
I think one thing, and this is something we tried to address with these pen and paper competitions, right, is that towards the end of the contest, we'd have these problems where you would have the one problem, but three different variants of the same problem. So for instance, maybe the problem was solve a Sudoku, right? And so you'd start with a 2x2 Sudoku, and then you'd have a 4x4 Sudoku, and then you'd have a 9x9 Sudoku or something, right? So you'd have three versions of the problem to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so the idea would be that in the first couple of versions of the problem, people are just following their nose and just playing around. But so that, as it, like the simplest version of the problem, they're just really trial and error. The medium version of the problem, they start to get used to it and they start seeing shortcuts, right? And here you're relying on the fact that an essential skill of a mathematician is to be lazy. Yeah. And being lazy means that you look for these sorts of shortcuts that will reduce your effort, but not lose any information and not get anything wrong. And so you start looking for faster ways of solving the problem. And then eventually, and that's, by the way, computer scientists have a word for that, which is algorithm, right? So people are sort of just by virtue of trying to find shortcuts, they are in their heads developing algorithms, even if that's not what they're writing down on pen and paper. And so then by the time they solve the large version of the problem, if they haven't got that algorithm in their head, they can't do it. It's too hard. But if they do, then they can do it quickly and move on. And so that was the intention, is to get people to not formalize the idea, but at least to go through the process in their heads of finding shortcuts, try a smaller version of the problem, try a simpler version of the problem, try 10 different variants of the problem, and to get your head around what cheap tricks you can use and what heuristics and shortcuts you can use that will speed up your solution without losing any information. And that's I think, where, at least to me, where algorithmic thinking starts to come from.
I mean, that's not too far off with the kind of advice that people give us about how to encourage mathematical thinking in school. I mean, like when I worked with you at the National Arts Summer School, when I was tutoring at National Arts Summer School, that's sort of the kind of things that you were encouraging us tutors to encourage the students. And it doesn't sound like it's too far off. So, I mean, this is a maths podcast, and I think we haven't stopped talking about maths this whole time. But I do want to tie it back to be more explicitly about maths. And I want to ask you the question that we ask all of our guests, which is to complete the sentence, a mathematician is someone who.
Oh, you warned me that this question was coming, and I thought I should think up a good answer, and I didn't think up a good answer. A mathematician is someone who, I would say, a mathematician is someone who doesn't trust experimentation and doesn't trust testing and sees but doesn't trust patterns but only trusts logic. What do I mean by that? I mean, you can have a conjecture that you have tested on a million cases, but mathematicians still won't believe it until they have a rigorous, logical, cold, hard proof, right? I think that's one of the things that distinguishes mathematics from all of the other sciences. We don't use the scientific method. We don't build a hypothesis. Look at physicists, right? Physicists will build a hypothesis. They will try and break that hypothesis through experimentation. And until they're able to break that hypothesis through experimentation, which they should be trying to do, the hypothesis stands as believed fact. And then at some point, if someone breaks it with an experiment, it's no longer true, right? Newton's laws of physics were true until they weren't, yeah? And then relativity is true until it's not, yeah? So mathematicians, in contrast, mathematicians will see an experiment run a million times, and they'll look very, very hard to find a counterexample, to find some case that breaks your conjecture, and they won't be able to, but they still won't believe it. They still don't take that thing as fact until somebody proves it. And there are so many fabulous, difficult, famous open problems that people would bet houses on that they think they know the answer to, but nobody trusts the answer because we don't have cold, logical, hard proofs.
Many thanks to Ben for talking to us for this episode. To find out more about Ben, you can visit his webpage linked in the show notes. This episode was produced by Adi Ganguly and myself. We're going to be off with the interviews over the Christmas and New Year break, but we'll be back with a new interview in January. Neumann Talk is a podcast produced by students and staff from the School of Mathematics and Statistics at UNSW Sydney and hosted by me, Yudi Bunyamin. Follow UNSW Maths and Stats on Facebook or Instagram to see updates on the latest episodes as well as other exciting news from our school. If you've been listening to our podcast, then we'd love to hear from you. Send me a tweet or a message on Twitter at Yudi_Bunyamin. Let us know who you are and if there's something one of the winners talked about that really resonated with you, or even if you have any questions about mathematics of your own.